I'm Afshin Ratansi and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from Dubai in the UAE. Today sees a landmark moment for Russia as it is scheduled to land a spacecraft on the moon for the first time in almost half a century. But what does the building of a moon base mean for Moscow? Its economy now replacing Germany as the biggest in Europe by GDP at purchasing power parity. And what is the real significance of tomorrow's 15th BRICS summit in South Africa? Billed as a meeting to finally and irrevocably disrupt post-1945 US hegemonic power. Power that has seen tens of millions or even more killed, wounded or displaced by NATO nation aggression around the world. Joining me now from Moscow is the Director General of the Russian International Affairs Council and Program Director of the influential Valdai Club, Professor Ivan Timofeev. Thank you so much, Professor, for coming on. So, you know, this moon landing, Ursula von der Leyen, I don't know what future historians will say about how she was as the boss of the European Union. She famously said that you're down to recycling silicon chips from dishwashers and washing machines because of the sanctions. How many dishwashers and washing machines did it take for the moon, the Luna 25, to start this moon base on the moon?
Well, I assume that no single washing machine has suffered yet. So I believe that our industry managed to launch this station without the use of any chips from these sophisticated washing machines. But to be serious, I believe this is a significant step for our space industry. We haven't done this for quite a long time, and it's a landmark for our moon program.
Yeah, actually, more seriously about the sanctions, before I get to the BRICS summit in South Africa tomorrow, what does it mean that some of these companies are now returning to Russia, Volkswagen, Duracell batteries? These companies are coming back to Russia. Are they just going to be welcomed back with open arms, even though they refuse to, in a sense, support the Russia war effort against what it sees as Nazism in Europe?
Well, actually, last year, dozens of companies, Western companies, left. Some of them did this emotionally. Others anticipated the significant slump of Russian economy. Now it turns that the Russian market is still quite big and significant, that they are taking financial losses due to their withdrawal from the market. So some of the of those who had left are getting back. And actually, as far as I know, the government does not demand from them any political commitments. So they are required to pay taxes and to...
But they face no further penalty for abandoning Russia. And of course, when it comes to batteries, say, I mean, surely Russia-manufactured batteries should take precedence, you'd think, if the government believes that they were steadfast in the war effort.
Well, you see that it's easy to lose the market. It's very hard to get it back, right? So, I wouldn't say that political factors here are crucial. The economy matters much more. When Western companies left, others replaced them quite quickly. I mean, first of all, Russian competitors and those from non-Western states, they were quite fast to come. So now it's quite a tricky task to get back this market back.
Well, no matter what's happening with interest rates and the currency, it's all very different to how Western analysts and corporate mainstream media in NATO nations had it as regards the Russian economy. But let's go to BRICS then. I mean, massive changes to the global political architecture, but you don't think it looks ridiculous that Vladimir Putin cannot go to the BRICS summit because South Africa thinks it might arrest the R in BRICS? I mean, what sort of situation is Russia in that its leader is imprisoned in Moscow?
Well, I would say that, of course, that the situation is ridiculous, and I believe
it's
that...
It's ridiculous because the Russian government has not got the South Africa government to agree to allowing him to come, surely.
Well, I would say that it harms to the host country's reputation not less than it harms to Russia. right? It seems that all the sides could benefit from the presence of the Russian leader. But anyway, the event is significant, and the capability of the economies of the member states, of BRIC member states, is quite huge. And now with the sanctions against Russia, there is a growing understanding in the non-Western world that more efforts to be done to build more autonomous alternative financial system, not to be subject.
Yeah, and NATO, sorry to interrupt, but NATO nations will be looking at BRICS and saying, yeah, whatever they're talking about de-dollarization and a new world, they can't even get the Russian leader there because such is the power of Washington, which isn't even a member of the International Criminal Court, such is the power of the European Union. And this court that has imprisoned mostly black African leaders, that Putin can't even go to the meeting. There's a win for Brussels. There's a win for London and Washington.
This cannot stop the fundamental changes in the approaches of non-Western countries to the international finance. So the politicization of this US-led financial system increases concerns in the non-Western worlds and increases the search for alternative ways to maintain normal market financial transactions.
Okay, well, sorry, you may say that, but to the rest of the world, it shows such is the pressure on Cyril Ramaphosa, and I don't know whether Ramaphosa would be alive without the sacrifice of the Russian people during apartheid South Africa when Britain and the United States were supporting the apartheid regime. I mean, there's Ramaphosa saying he can't guarantee the safety of Putin. What exactly is going on? Why exactly is your understanding is why Putin is unable to travel to South Africa?
Well, because there is a risk that enforcement agencies of South Africa may commit to the order of the International Criminal Court, and they may taken an effort to detain or to make any processual action against the Russian leader. So there is.
Well, and given this context, Sergei Lavrov can trust a word that comes out of the South African government.
There is a decision, as far as I know, that the minister participates in the meeting. And, well, let's hope that no political incident will happen around his visit.
Well, clearly Putin isn't going to go. I mean, apparently Ramaphosa did say Russia would be at war with South Africa de facto if Putin was arrested on arrival. I mean, can you see how this looks? I mean, Russia has completely lost the PR and propaganda war in NATO nations, in Europe, in Britain, in the United States. Some people may say it's slightly changing now because of the amount of money they're pouring into at the expense of their own populations. So Russia loses the propaganda war there, and now the BRICS summit, it looks like this.
Well, I wouldn't say that the goal of Russia is to win a propaganda war. The goal of Russia is to promote its national interests, right? So now it's clear that the structure of the media narrative in the NATO countries is not favorable to any attempt to bring an alternative point of view. Right. So it's simply useless to do this in this current point. However, what we see in the West is the rise of the of alternative opinions, which are more sensitive to the Russian views and which are increasingly taking them into the account.
Yeah, clearly those voices are diminished deliberately by European powers, sometimes by law, such as in Britain. You don't think that behind the scenes there will be people at the BRICS summit saying, look, we can play this both ways. We're getting the cheap Russian energy at discount rates, and it's fine. You know, we had Indian Congress MP on Shashi Tharoor the other day. He's talking about favorably about the massive India-Washington arms deal, 5-year roadmap. they're doing all this, they're playing it all both sides, and it's fine, and presumably we're not hearing about the kind of other stresses and pressures. I mean, to think that Lula, President Lula of Brazil, who is on this program, talking about the de facto Washington-backed coup against him, and he's there smiling with Biden only the other month. I mean, how how do you see that?
Well, I would say that this is a natural state of affairs. These are big sovereign powers, right? So they have their interests in relations with the West, with the United States in particular. And this is not the goal of Russia to detach them from the West. So the point of Russia is just to have an alternative, right? So not to be 100% dependent on one pole of the in the international order, right? And Russia actually proposes to have alternatives, to have a diversification of financial relations, political relations, etc. So the Russian point is not about the choice between them and us, right?
Yeah, but I mean, there's a class element here. We know all about how Russian elites who've been educated in the so-called West, in business schools and the like, learning neoliberalism off by heart, they, well, to those who don't support that ideology, believe they infest Moscow society. You know, you go to Moscow and there's a newspaper called the Moscow Times on the table in the hotel going, everything Putin does is rubbish and the country's gone to the dogs. It's not like if you stay at the equivalent hotel in London where you see a newspaper saying, well, actually saying the same thing and not criticizing its own government.
Yeah. Well, I would not over-exaggerate the impact of Western education on the views of the Russians who have such an education, right?
Because sorry to interrupt. You don't know these Moscow elite type children who all run off to Europe, and some of them who've escaped the draft.
Well, some of them did, but many others have not, right? So it's we should not over-generalize. Same is about the education. In the West or in China, right? So, of course, those people are getting better understanding of the countries where they get diplomas, but at the same time, they are gaining critical professional skills, right, which they can implement here in Russia. So it's not just about politicization or soft power. But you are right in the sense that Western media are quite influential, and what Russia lacks is the existence of similar media capabilities globally.
Professor Ivan Timofeyev, I'll stop you there. More from the program director of the Valdai Club and director general of the Russian International Affairs Council after this break.
Neutrality is one of the most flexible concepts in international relations that you can imagine, which is why it's so useful, but why it is so inherently difficult to grasp. So the chances we have is that countries fill it with a meaning that is useful to them and hopefully to others, because at its core it means I'm not taking the side of either of these completely.
What is the Ukraine conflict really all about? We're told it's about democracy. Others say it's about the rules-based order, whatever that means. In fact, there is nothing noble about this conflict. It's just another huge grift. Those in power want to keep it that way.
Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Professor Ivan Timofeyev, Program Director of the Valdai Club and Director General of the Russian International Affairs Council. You know, Professor, I was talking about problems at home, maybe class dimensions to it. Just explain how it is that, I mean, even NATO nation media couldn't avoid the fact. How is it that Russia's GDP by PPP has made Russia the strongest economy in Europe, despite being the most sanctioned country in history?
Last year, most of the forecasts implied that Russian economy would slump significantly, but almost all of them failed, right? So in reality, the economy performs quite well. I wouldn't say that it lacks problems. A number of problems are there. The major current problem is the cost of the national currencies. However, the financial system is quite stable. The supplies of critical goods are quite stable too. And what is most important is that the Russian producers are feeling much better in this situation, because they are now having less competitors and they have more space on the market to operate, right? So I'm not surprised now that Russian economy shows these results. However, my optimism is quite cautious. There are still a number of problems we have to solve, including the substitution of critical equipment, which is now under the export control of the US, European Union, and others.
Can you not trade? Are you talking about electronics there?
Yeah, electronics is most critical. So to some extent, we are replacing the losses by means of our own industry, but this is not enough. The cooperation with China is another avenue, and Chinese are now under the sanctions too. They are sanctioned by the United States, especially in terms of chips, in terms of semiconductors. So in a sense, we are in the same boat with China, and we have to promote our own industries.
You think a lack of preparation and strategy on the part of the Russian government, of the Putin government, that they didn't see that the importance of having a strategic power in these industries, as the United States has triumphed with the big five electronics companies like Amazon, Apple, and Meta, and the Google?
Well, actually, their understanding of the significance of these branches had been there even before the crisis in Ukraine. However, now the export control from the West is a huge spur to promote the development of our own production, and where we cannot achieve immediate goals to cooperate with others, with other friendly states, as we call them, and China is among the major partners in this regard.
Of course, all of this is not in a vacuum, and we've seen that while the conflict and the war rages in Europe, we've seen the United States at play in Nigeria, in Ecuador, bases in the Philippines, and now the Senate Foreign Relations Chair Bob Menendez is threatening Kyrgyzstan. Explain the significance of what's going on in Kyrgyzstan and how maybe it's emblematic. They can go into any global South country and threaten them.
Well, recently four companies from Kyrgyzstan have been sanctioned by the U.S. Department of the Treasury. However, it should be noted that these companies are quite small and they are more or less brand new. I wouldn't over-exaggerate these blocking sanctions against these companies. If you look at the statistics of these secondary sanctions, to the nature of them at this current point, you will see that most of them are used against quite small companies, which are usually used as intermediaries.
I mean, Fidel Castro showed how you beat sanctions, but do you think the era after him and after the Cuban Missile Crisis has shown this Ukraine situation really means the end of the United States, a weapon of choice that has hurt so many families all around the world for decades now?
Cuba survived significant sanctions, and it still exists as a sovereign state, right? So, but Russia is much a big economy. It's much harder to isolate it. And actually, the Russian experience is a huge signal to others to get prepared to similar scenario. I mean, China is apparently getting this experience into account very seriously, and others too.
Yeah, of course, life expectancy now higher in Cuba than the United States. And famously, it was Cuba that helped Angola against the British-American-backed apartheid regime in Angola. I don't know whether that will be talked about at the BRICS summit tomorrow. What is your understanding of the role of this Wagner group? Because whilst NATO nation media clearly tried to ignore the St. Petersburg summit, where so many African representatives were present, I think some of them looked aghast at how Russia had managed to have such a conference in the first place. They keep saying, oh, the Niger, the uranium superpower of Niger, this is all because of Wagner. What is the role of Wagner, as your understanding is now? And, I mean, what is it? Who is Prigozhin? Just very briefly, because a lot of people are confused about what all that was.
Well, actually, there are lots of speculations around both Wagner and Mr. Prigozhin. I believe that what is important is that the summit in St. Petersburg was not just a number of declarations, right? It implied concrete, substantial things, including the cooperation in information security, in energy, in a number of industrial spheres, in education, etc. So this was not just a declaration, right? It was not just a toast. And of course, Russia is increasingly a supply of security in a number of African states.
But why does it need to use privatized military elements? I mean, we talked about Cuba. I mean, they openly said, we're going to help places like Angola when they were facing British-American apartheid racism and the South African troops there. Why can't Russia and China come to a deal to help these countries in the face of what's clearly... I mean, in the case of Nigeria, we now know facts about the Nigerian leader and how he was related to drug deals in Chicago. I mean, surely now is the time for China and Russia to start putting troops in Africa to stabilize these countries from U.S. and NATO aggression.
Well, it's pretty hard to command these security affairs because most of them are naturally...
At the invitation. I meant at the invitation of governments of Africa, not just moving in like the United States does.
Yeah, but actually, their contemporary international relations have different dimensions, right? And we had witnessed the privatization of security relations long before the emergence of Russian private military companies, right? Remember American companies in Afghanistan, for instance. So I would say that this is not just the Russian, the trend related to Russia.
Russia's copying that failed example of the Americans.
Well, I wouldn't say that it copies the failed example, but there is a trend that the provision of security and security as such is getting more diversified with the existence of an emergence of non-state actors in this business.
Do you think Russia is going to give up the war of attrition and go for some kind of knockout blow and finish this war once and for all against the NATO-backed forces in Ukraine? Or is attrition the way forward?
Well, what we see now is that the counter-offense of Ukrainian troops is stagnating, if not collapsing.
Some call the Russia operation the counter-offense, arguably. But anyway, yes.
I'm not sure that the West and the Ukrainians are ready for negotiations with Russia and are ready to take the Russian concerns, but the fact that their Ukrainian counteroffense is collapsing is bolstering the Russian positions.
Clearly, when I mean, this is an anniversary of Afghanistan as well. Yeah, this month, the defeat of the United States' longest war, and Hollywood has not been able to even come to terms with that when it comes to soft power. The writers, the actors, the whole cultural elites in NATO nations are not able to come to terms with some of NATO's recent defeats. Do you think Russia, China, the BRICS countries will ever be able to compete with the kind of cultural capital that Hollywood and the big television corporations of New York have over the entire world? I mean, as far as I understand it, RT is not that readily available in South Africa amongst some cable operators. So there you have CNN and other arguable propaganda outlets beaming out into the townships while the BRICS summit goes on. How is China and Russia and other global South countries going to get their message through?
Well, it's uneasy to compete, but actually what we see is that China, Russia, and a number of others other great powers are trying to promote their own visions and their own products, let's put it like this. So if you look at the Chinese cinema, for instance, cinema production, it is now developing quite rapidly, right? It's not comparable to Hollywood, but actually they are they feel quite well in at their domestic market, and their domestic market is 1.4 billion of people, right? So it's quite huge.
I mean, just finally, some people say that the Russian government and Russian strategists have continually assumed that their opponent is rational throughout this situation, the terrible tragedy of 14,000 dead since the coup in Kiev in 2014. How far do you think Biden will go in winning this war as he sees it? Of course, we all lose in any war. How far is he going to go, given that we now know Putin was hoodwinked by Angela Merkel and the rest of them at the Minsk agreements? I don't know why Putin believed them. Right now, are think tanks like yours, Russian Affairs Council, prepared for how far Biden is to go, whether it be for Hunter Biden and the contracts, or for how Tony Blinken and the rest sees not only contracts, but U.S. hegemonic power?
Well, you see that what we may witness is a clash of different rationalities. So on the one hand, it's rational for the United States to make a deal with Russia not to spend these huge resources to support Ukraine and to face the risk of escalation, and including the escalation to nuclear conflict. On the other hand, there is another rationality which implies the fear of defeat, the fear of the loss of face, right? The fear to lose reputation, etc. So the question is, what rationality would prevail at the end? And of course, it's pretty hard to forecast this in any reliable way.
Professor Ivan Timofeyev, thank you. And that's it for the show. We'll be back on Saturday with the penultimate episode of this season. Until then, you can keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. And head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.